Hey everyone, and welcome back. Are you ready to dive into some seriously ancient history?
I'm ready.
Today we are looking at Judges chapter 17 and 18.
Okay.
It's a story that honestly has everything. We've got like DIY religion, a whole tribe on the move, and a lot of what were they thinking moments.
Lots of those in Judges.
For real. It's a window into a time when things were, shall we say, a little less structured in ancient Israel.
It really gives you a sense of what it was like when there was no king, you know,
right. No
central authority. Everyone was kind of making things up as they went along.
If it feels right, do it.
Exactly. It's a time the Book of Judges describes as everyone did what was right in their own eyes.
And let me tell you, some of those choices were interesting.
Oh, yeah.
The source material we're using for this deep dive is an academic lecture that really unpacks this wild tale.
Okay.
And it suggests that these events might have actually happened before some of the earlier stories in Judges.
Oh, wow.
Talk about timeline shenanigans.
That's a head scratcher.
I know, right? Yeah. But hey, who doesn't love a good origin story?
It's like a prequel giving you a glimpse into the events that set the stage for, you know, everything that comes later.
Exactly. So we start with Micah, a guy from the tribe of Ephraim, who decides he wants his own personal shrine.
Mm-hmm.
Seems harmless enough, right?
Well, you know, until you get into the details.
Yeah.
Micah's mother kicks things off by dedicating some silver to the Lord.
Okay.
To make a carved image and a metal image for this shrine.
And that's where, like, my alarm bells are starting to go off.
Yeah.
Isn't that a big no-no according to the Ten Commandments?
Absolutely.
No graven images and all that.
Yeah. It's a classic example of what scholars call syncretism.
Okay.
Essentially mixing different religious beliefs and practices together.
So she's trying to honor the God of Israel.
Right.
But also incorporating some, like, other elements. It's like she's trying to have her cake and eat it too.
Yeah. And we see this happening throughout Israelite history. You know, there's actually an inscription found at an archaeological site called Kuntilet Ashrud that calls upon Yahweh, the God of Israel, alongside Asherah, a Canaanite goddess.
Wow. They really weren't shy about blending those beliefs.
Nope.
Makes you wonder what was going through their minds, right?
It definitely raises questions about how people understood the divine and how they sought to interact with it.
So Micah's mom is already, like, setting a precedent.
Yeah.
And Micah takes it a step further. He even makes his own son a priest, which, if I remember correctly, wasn't exactly how the Israelite priesthood was supposed to work.
Not at all. The priesthood was a very specific lineage. Micah's son wouldn't have qualified.
Interesting.
It's another sign that things were, let's just say, flexible when it came to religious practices back then.
Micah's really going all in on this, like, DIY religion. It's like he's creating his own custom-made belief system.
And it really highlights the consequences of having no strong central leadership.
Yeah.
Without a king or a clear authority figure, everyone's interpreting things in their own way.
Right.
Often with unforeseen results.
So Micah's got his unauthorized shrine, his homemade idols, and his son playing the role of priest. It's a whole family affair.
It really is.
But then a young Levite from Bethlehem shows up, and things take another interesting turn.
And this isn't just any Levite now. Bethlehem wasn't a designated Levitical city, which makes his presence there a little unusual, almost like he's a spiritual freelancer traveling around looking for work.
What's interesting is that Micah's thrilled to have a real Levite join his, like, makeshift operation.
Yeah.
He thinks this will finally legitimize his shrine and bring him prosperity.
He even says, "Now I know that the Lord will prosper me because I have a Levite as a priest."
He seems convinced that he's finally cracked the code. But I can't help but think his logic is a bit flawed.
I see what you mean.
He's mixing genuine elements, like having a Levite, with practices that are, like, completely off script.
Yeah, it's like he's trying to build a house using, you know, bricks and straw.
Hmm.
You might get something that resembles a structure, but it's not going to be very stable.
And this raises a question for you listening.
Mm-hmm.
How often do we find ourselves blending beliefs or practices without really questioning their origins?
Right.
Or thinking critically about their implications?
Mm-hmm.
Are there areas in our own lives where we're mixing and matching, maybe without even realizing it?
It's something worth considering, especially as we move further into the story and see the consequences of these choices play out.
So we've got Micah with his unconventional shrine and his newly hired Levite. Mm-hmm. But meanwhile, another group is about to enter the picture.
Uh-oh.
The tribe of Dan. And let me tell you, they are on a mission.
Okay.
They're desperately searching for land.
Yeah.
A place to finally call home.
Right.
And their quest is about to intersect with Micah's story in a pretty dramatic way.
They were supposed to have land on the coast, but they were having trouble securing it. In fact, the Canaanites living there actually drove them out.
That's rough.
It's like planning a vacation and finding out your hotel reservation got canceled. Not exactly the best way to start your journey.
Nope.
And what's fascinating is that this story takes place before the events described in Joshua 19, which tells of the Danites eventually settling further north. So here we see them in a vulnerable state, searching for a place to put down roots.
And as they're wandering around, guess who their scouts stumble upon? Micah and his Levite. It's like fate. Or maybe just really bad luck, depending on how you look at it.
It's certainly a pivotal moment in the story. The Danites, seeing this shrine and its priest, ask the Levite to consult God for them.
Again, more unauthorized religious practices. These guys are really making things up as they go along. But I guess when you're desperate for guidance, you'll turn to any source of authority, even if it's, you know, a little questionable.
And remember, this is a time when people were seeking divine guidance for all sorts of decisions, big and small. It's not surprising that the Danites would want some reassurance before venturing further into unknown territory.
Okay, so the Danites have encountered Micah, his makeshift shrine, and his Levite for hire. What happens next? Do they find their land? Does Micah ever realize that maybe, just maybe, he's not exactly on the right path?
Ooh, good questions.
Stay tuned, because we'll be right back to unpack the rest of this story.
I can't wait.
We're back, and things are about to get, let me tell you, a whole lot more complicated for Micah and the Danites.
It's amazing how one seemingly small encounter can set off a chain of events with, like, huge consequences.
So last we left off, the Danite scouts had stumbled upon Micah and his shrine.
Right.
Even as the Levite for guidance.
Hmm.
What happened when they reported back to the rest of the tribe?
Well, they definitely mentioned Micah's shrine, but, you know, it wasn't just about the religious aspect. Mm. They were particularly interested in the valuables.
The valuables. Okay.
The idols, the ephod, all the things that Micah had collected for his shrine.
Sounds like those scouts weren't just looking for spiritual guidance.
Right.
They were also sizing up the place.
Yeah.
Maybe see what they could get their hands on.
And remember, this was a time when portable wealth was really important.
Okay.
Things like idols and religious artifacts weren't just symbolic. They represented, like, real value.
So when the main Danite force, all 600 warriors, arrived at Micah's place, I'm guessing they weren't there for a friendly chat.
You guessed it. They essentially robbed Micah blind.
Oh.
Taking everything of value, the idols, the ephod, the whole works.
Jeez.
And to add insult to injury, they convinced the Levite to come along with them.
Wow. Talk about a hostile takeover.
Yeah.
I can only imagine Micah's reaction trying to protest while this group of warriors is just stripping him of everything.
Yeah.
And what about the Levite?
Well,
did he put up any resistance?
Surprisingly, no. The Danites managed to persuade him that it was a promotion, you know, to be the priest for an entire tribe instead of just serving one man.
Okay.
They appealed to his ambition, promising him a much larger audience and greater influence.
So he just went along with them. That's a pretty drastic career change.
It is.
Do you think it was purely ambition, or was there something else going on?
It's hard to say for sure. Maybe he felt threatened, or maybe he genuinely saw it as a better opportunity, but it definitely raises questions about his character.
Yeah.
And his commitment to Micah.
It makes you wonder if he had any, like, genuine religious convictions, or if he was just in it for the perks.
Mm.
It's a reminder that religious figures aren't always what they seem.
And it's interesting how easily he was swayed by the promise of power and prestige.
Yeah.
You know, it's a human flaw that we see throughout history, the temptation to choose personal gain over integrity.
So the Danites have their loot, their stolen priest, and they're on the move again. Where did this land-grabbing adventure finally lead them?
They continued north until they reached a city called Laish.
Okay.
Described as a peaceful and prosperous place, completely unaware of the approaching danger.
Uh-oh. That doesn't sound good.
Yeah, it's like, you know those classic horror movies where the unsuspecting town is about to get a very rude awakening?
Right.
And that's exactly what happened. The Danites launched a brutal attack, killing the inhabitants and burning the city to the ground.
Wow. That's a pretty drastic way to solve their land problem.
It is.
It's a stark reminder of the violence and brutality that often characterize this period of history.
And it's not just about the physical violence. There's also this sense of, like, moral corruption.
Yeah.
A disregard for human life. you know, and basic principles of justice.
So the Danites achieved their goal, but at a terrible cost. They now had their land, but it was built on, like, this foundation of bloodshed and stolen goods.
Yeah.
You have to wonder if they felt any remorse or if the ends justified the means in their minds.
There's no mention of regret or guilt in the text.
Mm.
Instead, they rebuild the city, rename it Dan after their ancestor, and set up Micah's stolen shrine as their own.
So this whole operation, this religious Frankenstein's monster they've created, becomes the official religion of the tribe of Dan. It's hard to believe that something so messed up could become so ingrained in their culture.
And what's even more shocking is that this unauthorized priesthood, this lineage descended from Micah's stolen Levite, continues for centuries, all the way until Babylonian exile.
It's amazing how something that started with one man's desire for, like, a personal shrine, could spiral into such a long-lasting and far-reaching consequence. Mm-hmm. It's a reminder that our choices, even those that seem small or insignificant, can have a ripple effect that extends far beyond our own lives.
And it raises an important question for us.
Okay.
How often do we fail to consider the long-term impact of our decisions?
Right.
Especially when it comes to matters of faith and morality.
Yeah.
You know, do we ever stop to think about how our actions might affect future generations?
That's a pretty heavy question. It's easy to get caught up in our own, like, immediate needs and desires.
Yeah.
But this story reminds us that we have a responsibility to think beyond ourselves.
It's not just about individual choices. The story also highlights the dangers of groupthink and the ways in which entire communities can become complicit in, you know, unethical or harmful behavior.
Okay, so we've got Micah with his questionable shrine, a wandering Levite looking for opportunity, and the Danites willing to do whatever it takes to get what they want. It's a recipe for disaster. And we've seen how it all played out.
And the narrator of Judges is very clear about the spiritual and moral climate of this time. He even states that God is absent from this story, which is a pretty chilling statement considering how central God was to their identity.
It's like they've completely lost their moral compass.
Right.
Driven by their own selfish desires and justifications.
Mm.
But as we wrap up this part of our deep dive, the question that lingers is, are we any different today?
Hmm. That's a good one.
Are we immune to the same temptations, the same rationalizations that led to such devastating consequences in this story?
That's what we'll be exploring in the final part of our deep dive. Stay with us as we unpack the modern relevance of this ancient tale and consider how its lessons might apply to our own lives.
Okay, so we've been unpacking this wild story of Micah and, you know, his homemade shrine and the Danites' quest for land.
Yeah.
It's a story filled with, like, twists and turns and some pretty questionable choices.
And as we saw in the last part, those choices had, you know, far-reaching consequences impacting not just the individuals involved, but the entire tribe of Dan for generations.
Exactly. It really makes you think about the ripple effect of our actions.
Okay.
But the question that's really stuck with me is, are we any different today?
Right.
Are we immune to the same temptations and justifications that led Micah and the Danites down such a destructive path?
It's easy to judge people in the past.
Yeah.
See their mistakes and just shake our heads at their choices.
Right.
But I think this story challenges us to, like, look inward, to ask ourselves some tough questions about our own beliefs and behaviors.
Because, let's be honest, we might not be building physical shrines or stealing idols, but are there other ways we're, you know, doing what's right in our own eyes? Even if it goes against our stated values or principles.
I think it's about recognizing those, you know, subtle ways we might be creating our own idols, things we prioritize above all else, even if they lead us to compromise our integrity.
So instead of carved images, our modern idols might be things like success, wealth, comfort, or even certain ideologies.
Precisely. And just as the Danites justified their violence in the name of, you know, securing land, we might find ourselves justifying our own harmful actions by twisting our beliefs or simply ignoring inconvenient truths.
It's like that saying, the road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Yeah.
We might start with, you know, noble goals, but if we're not careful, we can easily stray from our values and end up in a very different place than we intended.
Absolutely. So how do we avoid falling into those traps? How do we make sure we're not just creating our own versions of morality to suit our desires?
That's the million-dollar question.
Yeah.
Where do we even start?
I think it begins with humility.
Okay.
Recognizing that we don't have all the answers. You know, that we're all susceptible to self-deception and flawed reasoning.
So being willing to admit we might be wrong.
Right.
That our perspective isn't always the only valid one.
Exactly. And it's also crucial to, you know, cultivate self-awareness,
okay,
to be honest with ourselves about what we truly value and how those values are reflected in our actions.
It's like taking a step back and asking, okay, what am I really chasing here? Is this decision, this action, truly aligned with the person I want to be?
And another crucial ingredient is having a community.
Yeah.
People who can challenge our assumptions, hold us accountable, and help us stay on track when we're tempted to, you know, wander.
It's like having a support system. People who know us well enough to call us out when we're starting to, like, rationalize or justify behaviors that go against our principles.
And that community doesn't have to be limited to people who agree with us all the time.
Right.
In fact, engaging with diverse perspectives can be incredibly helpful in challenging our biases and preventing us from getting stuck in, you know, echo chambers.
It's about being open to different viewpoints.
Yeah.
Being willing to listen and learn, even when it's uncomfortable.
Right. Because if we only surround ourselves with people who think exactly like us, it's easy to lose sight of the bigger picture and start believing our own hype.
So as we wrap up this deep dive into the story of Micah and the Danites, what's the takeaway for you listening? What can we learn from this ancient tale that's still relevant today?
For me, it's a cautionary reminder that faith and morality aren't just like personal preferences or things we can pick and choose based on convenience.
Right.
They have real-world consequences, both for ourselves and for those around us.
It's a call to be intentional about the choices we make.
Right.
To examine our motivations and to ensure our actions are aligned with our, you know, deepest values and principles.
And it's a reminder that while we might not be perfect, we can always strive to be better, to learn from the mistakes of the past, and to create a future where doing what's right isn't a recipe for chaos and destruction, but a path towards, you know, a more just and compassionate world.
I think that's a great note to end on. Thanks for joining us on this journey. And until next time, keep questioning, keep learning, and keep striving to do what's right, even when it's hard.